Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. Today we talk about the use of hormonal therapy in the management of prostate cancer with Dr. Matthew Smith from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. This is going to be a two-part series, and this is the first of two. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by Dr. Smith, just type them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. Well, as always, we have a very short pre-evaluation for you to take. It'll take about a minute or two. You'll get a lot more out of this if you take it, and it'll help us understand your needs as well. And we're going to put a break back up for you to take at the end of the conference as well, see what you took away from this. If you're into audio programs, and we know a lot of people end up listening to these webinars while they're driving or working out, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Srinivas on presentations from the recent ASCO meeting on GU cancers. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow, we're actually working with Dr. Smith's colleague at MGH, Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell, in a two-part series on BCMA-directed therapy myeloma. We actually have some videos of patients that we're going to show as well in that program. Next week, we're doing a really fascinating program on the use of immunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer. That's a topic we could talk about for a long time. And another topic with a lot of granularity on next Thursday with Drs. Matalonis and Richardson, the treatment of ovarian cancer. The following week, on November the 8th, we'll be working with Lisa Carey on our HER2-positive breast cancer series. And then we'll be working with Dr. Paul Richardson from Dana-Farber in our Myeloma Meet the Professor series as well. We're doing two big satellite meetings, as we always do, at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in December. If you're around San Antonio at the meeting, check it out, or also put it out online. We'll be doing a program on HER2-positive and ER-positive disease. And then the next day, we're actually heading over to, where are we going? New Orleans, right, where the ASH meeting is. And we're doing three symposiums on the big satellite the day on Friday, CLL, lymphomas, and multiple myeloma. But today, we're here to talk about hormonal therapy of prostate cancer. So much going on in GU cancers in general, including prostate cancer and hormonal therapy. As we always do in this series, we have several docs will be presenting cases from their practice. These are all general medical oncologists other than Dr. Morris, who's a urologic oncologist. Here's where we're heading. I want to ask Matt a little bit about some new directions in hormonal therapy. We're really going to spend most of the time making rounds on a bunch of patients from practice. The second module really on the slide, in the slides is really a bunch of data slides on ongoing and reported clinical trials, also a bunch of review articles. We may dip into that, but we're really here to make rounds and to chat with Dr. Smith. So Matthew, first thing, I was kind of surprised to see when I went through all the things you're involved with, a couple of papers on abemaciclib. I feel like we talk about that all the time. In breast cancer, not only metastatic disease, but also in the adjuvant setting. And here we see a phase 3 style trial, the Cyclone 3 study, looking at adding abema to hormonal therapy, as we do in breast cancer, and high-risk metastatic hormone-sensitive. And then there's also, these are sort of trials in progress posters that you can check out, really get into what's going on with these. This is a phase 2-3 study, same strategy, and castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So Matthew, I thought this would be a good chance to sort of catch up a little bit about the biology, particularly as it relates to the hormonal system with prostate cancer and what we've learned that's new. Let's start out with CDK and abemaciclib. What's the thinking behind it? It kind of looks similar to what you do in breast cancer, adding it to hormones.
Yeah, and certainly history's told us that there's a lot of good reasons to look at the symmetries between breast and prostate cancer. And of course, CDK4/6 inhibition has a well-established role, approved therapies in breast cancer. And I think we can construct a similar compelling non-clinical rationale for doing it in prostate cancer. So the non-clinical studies have shown, you know, compelling preliminary information that CDK4/6 inhibition is important. And now we have these two great ongoing trials, Cyclone 2, looking at abema plus abiraterone in patients with mCRPC. That study fully accrued, follow-up phase will read out in the future, and then we'll look at those results. And then the follow-on study, moving that same regimen up earlier, cyclin 3 in mHSPC. So we'll get a lot of really interesting information from these trials in coming years, and will really serve to establish whether there's an important role for CDK4/6 inhibition in prostate cancer.
So always interesting to contrast also side effects that you see with drugs in men and women. What do you see with Abema? You know, with women, you see GI issues. And also, is it given every day, continuously? The other ones, Palbo and Ribo, aren't.
Yeah, given continuously. And the side effects, I think, fair to say, from the published reports from Cyclone 2 preliminary information, is that basically we're looking at a similar constellation of side effects to that previously reported in breast cancer.
So, you know, we've seen actually CDK has been looked at in endometrial cancer as well on the same strategy. What about the other CDK inhibitors? Again, in breast, you have the ribociclib and palbociclib. Are they being looked at as well?
I think we have less information about those in prostate cancer. There have been some small studies of monotherapy, but I think the Cyclone 2 and Cyclone 3 are really the trials that are going to, rigorously and critically address the role of CDK4/6 inhibition in prostate cancer.
You know, of course, this ties into one of the most interesting things about hormonal therapy in general, which is it doesn't work indefinitely. Usually the tumor finds a way to get around that. And of course, in many diseases, there's great interest in trying to, look at mutations and other abnormalities that explain why these therapies don't work indefinitely. What are some of the things that are being looked at in prostate cancer? Is there any role in liquid biopsy or looking for new mutations?
Yeah, we believe so. So this is an example of trying to extend the benefit of AR pathway inhibitors. AR is a highly validated target in prostate cancer. And so for me, any consideration of a novel way of targeting AR, whether it be by combination or novel therapy, really warrants close attention. There are other novel approaches that are being considered. The AR degrader that Arvinas is developing is one example of that, hoping to overcome resistance. And there, what's been observed is that through largely patients identified through liquid biopsies, in the 10 or 20% of patients who have certain activating missense mutations, which would predict that AR remains a driver, those patients tend to respond to AR degradation with ARV-110. So that's sort of turning out to be a really interesting narrative, and it raised the possibility that those specific missense mutations could be a biomarker for activity of that approach.
And is that kind of, analogous to fulvestrant in breast cancer?
Yeah, mechanism's different, but conceptually, yes, it's the same, trying to, target AR in this case by degradation. So ARV-110 is a PROTAC. Yeah.
Any other strategies to try to extend the duration of response? Again, I know in breast cancer they have this PIK3, AKT, I think it's called apatasertib. Do you have that kind of strategy cooking in prostate as well?
Yeah, there's been a reported phase 3 trial of abiraterone plus or minus apatasertib. I think I would characterize it as a near miss. There was sort of proof of principle. There was at least a directional benefit that did not quite reach statistical significance in the intention to treat population. So there was a signal there, although I don't think sufficiently compelling to move that forward with that drug in that setting. There are other approaches being considered as well. One might consider the combination therapy with PARP inhibitors, for example, as a strategy to extend the benefit of AR inhibition.
Yeah, that's a great thought. I never actually thought about it. You're right. It really is. That's exactly what the strategy is, because it is being combined with hormonal therapy. Well, I really want to make rounds with you today. Last weekend, we did our big day-long annual program, the Florida Cancer Specialists, covered 22 tumors. We had 16 investigators. And we had lots of people online watching that. So I figured people need a little bit of break from slides. So I thought we'd chat a little more and talk about cases more and sort of work that in like we're making rounds. So we're going to start out with a patient of Dr. Jennifer Dallas from Charlotte, North Carolina. And, you know, Matthew, it's been amazing these since we started doing these cases over Zoom and then bringing them into conferences, that the, you know, really getting a real view inside general medical oncology practice where these docs are taking care, you know, CLL, myeloma, you know, you name it. But yeah, and also you get really get a view about what's, you know, a little bit more about what's happening in clinical practice. So this is a patient who was who moved into to Charlotte, and then Dr. Dallas was referred to the patient because he, as you can see, he had a PSA of 150, gluten 4 plus fluor, and on initial workup was found to have upper abdominal adenopathy. And as she started to put together a treatment plan, of course, she wanted to find out what previous diseases the patient had. What the wife had to bring in, the patient's wife had to bring in the pills because they didn't really know what he was taking or why he was taking it. And when Dr. Dallas started to go through the pills, guess what she found? Imatinib. And it turns out that he had CML for 5 years and didn't realize it and been taking imatinib, complete molecular response. So made it a little bit different in trying to decide what to do with this hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. Here's Dr. Dallas.
He'd moved from another area. I was surprised. He didn't seem to know what he was taking. I had to have his wife bring in bottles so that we could figure out. But he was taking it, and he's still in a complete molecular response. So I'm just continuing him on the imatinib.
So your question was, should you have added docetaxel in addition?
Right. I was a little bit worried about hematologic problems in that patient.
Yeah. I don't know what happens when you give chemotherapy to somebody on imatinib for CML.
I don't know.
I'll ask Matt Smith.
He's doing well with the abiraterone and the leuprolide.
So I'm sure you get presented patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease all the time, but I don't know how many are actually on imatinib. And I don't even know. It just doesn't sound like a great idea to give a patient like that chemo. So first, any comments about this case, and then we'll use that as a way to kind of get into the topic of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease.
Yeah, so at a high level, I think this, so this, I guess, would be sort of a classic case of, you might think of as, you know, low volume de novo metastatic disease. I don't have all the details about the extensive site of his abdominal adenopathy, but we'll consider him low volume de novo metastatic disease. You know, ADT alone is no longer the standard of care with very few exceptions. So the choice here, I think, to treat him with ADT and abiraterone is outstanding. So it's either ADT plus an AR pathway inhibitor or triplet therapy with ADT and AR pathway inhibitor and docetaxel. ADT plus docetaxel is no longer an appropriate regimen either, I would say, because we've disproven that, approved superiority in two other trials by addition of an AR pathway inhibitor. So in this man, I would not feel compelled to add docetaxel. That's separate from the considerations about his leukemia, just because he's low volume disease. From what's been described, I probably wouldn't give him chemotherapy. And then with the additional information about the imatinib, I would avoid doing that. We also learned from Dr. Dallas that he had a great response to the doublet. The other consideration is the role of radiating the primary. And this is a case that I think would be a good candidate for radiating the primary based on the results of the STAMPEDE study reporting an OS benefit in the subgroup of patients with low burden metastatic de novo prostate cancer.
And she actually has him scheduled for that. I think he has some family things he wants to do first. But what about radiating the nodes?
Probably not, because if he had just pelvic adenopathy, sure. But with upper abdominal adenopathy, probably no, because he's almost certainly got nodes. It's fairly morbid to radiate upper abdominal nodes. And in that setting, it's quite likely has disease beyond that as well.
Could you go back over, you know, the thinking involved in radiating the prostate in patients with metastatic disease?
Well, I only take care of prostate cancer, but if we think about it more broadly, it's probably you're better at doing this than I am. It's like, you know, in almost every other tumor type, right, we control the primary by some means. So prostate cancer has long been the outlier where you don't treat the primary in de novo metastatic disease. And so that was the question addressed in the STAMPEDE trial. In the overall population and in a high volume subgroup, there was no benefit. But if you look in this in the low burden subgroup defined as like less than 5 bone metastases, there is an overall survival benefit of a magnitude that's not dissimilar to intensifying systemic treatment, say by addition of an AR pathway inhibitor. So it kind of makes sense, right? Like, so most of the diseases in the prostate, you probably avoid the, you know, morbidity and potentially mortality due to local disease progression. So I think intuitively it makes sense. And it's a nice example where, you know, the results of the randomized controlled trial were consistent with our intuition.
See, I kind of viewed it like debulking. I know it seems weird, but debulking surgery like you do with ovarian cancer.
Sure.
You know, you said low volume disease and really you're just radiating. I mean, you're not trying to cure the patient. Or I wouldn't think that would be very likely. But incidentally, Dr. Kumar from the Florida Cancer Specialty, he was actually there on Saturday, says he has a patient with a stage 3B lung cancer who had CML and knew it. And he actually discussed it with Dr. Cortez, and they stopped the dasatinib, gave the chemotherapy and radiation, then restarted the dasatinib. So that's kind of interesting. Anyhow, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the whole issue of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. That's really changed so much. I just want to bring up three other scenarios, just as maybe in contrast to this one particular case. And get your thoughts on, of course, the key question that everybody's asking is, when do you add in chemotherapy? As you said, I think everybody's gotten the message that androgen deprivation and AR pathway inhibitors is sort of the beginning. And then the question is, what about docetaxel? So I want to just start out with some practical clinical situations, and then we'll kind of backtrack into the data. So first case here, we have a younger patient with low volume disease. Second case is an older patient, 80, same thing, low volume disease. And then the third is back to the younger patient, but now with liver mets. So what would you, first of all, what would your favored AR pathway inhibitor be in this situation? And what about docetaxel?
Sure. So for all three, so 80, with few exceptions, ADT alone is not appropriate. So same is true for all three of these cases. So I'd recommend a backbone of ADT and an AR pathway inhibitor for all three cases. And the last case with multiple bone and liver metastases, I would add docetaxel, so triplet therapy. My preferred regimen would be ADT, darolutamide, and docetaxel based on the ARASENS data. So I think it's best in class for tolerability, and we have the most robust information about safety of triplet with darolutamide. In the first two cases, a little bit more, you know, options, I guess I would say, in terms of which choice of your AR pathway inhibitor. And you're going to look at the other, you know, comorbidities of the patient to make decisions about the best safety profile. There are a number of other interesting issues that are raised by these cases. The first two patients are low volume disease. So would you consider, like in the first patient, we would have a conversation about radiating the prostate as well as all the bone metastases, depending on their anatomic locations. We'd have less enthusiasm about radiation of the prostate and metastases in the 80-year-old patient because of his anticipated shorter overall survival based on his age alone.
So Aladdin in the chat room has a patient with PSA of 150, 4-plus Borg Gleason, but multiple extraskeletal mets, long lymph nodes. Does he need to biopsy any of these extranodal sites to rule out neuroendocrine cancer of the prostate?
I'm not hearing, probably no, if that's his presentation. You know, I would say no, PSA is elevated. You know, if the same patient with liver mets and a PSA of 3.5, like that's a different story. I'd feel compelled to biopsy, say, a liver metastases to exclude neuroendocrine differentiation. But there's, while in a case of aggressive prostate cancer, there's nothing about that case that leads me to be convinced that it's neuroendocrine transformation.
So just to continue, of course, you mentioned the ARASEN study. I think this is the most recent phase 3 trial that's come out in this arena. It was presented. You presented it at the GU symposium last February. Then it was published in the New England Journal. Basically, docetaxel by itself, which, as you say, as of this, is no longer likely option to consider, plus or minus darolutamide, then quickly published in the New England Journal. The most recent data you all just presented at the ESMO meeting, more follow-up data in terms of survival, and as we'll show in a second, a lot of great continuing great data in terms of tolerability. Can you kind of put this trial in context in terms of the previous work that was done with hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, why the design was set up this way, and kind of what you think the implications of this study is in this situation now?
So we now have this extraordinary body of work, including Aerosens, that tells us that addition of an AR pathway inhibitor is a priority. Level one evidence for improved survival with or without docetaxel in patients with de novo or recurrent metastatic prostate cancer, right? So it extends this narrative that AR pathway inhibition is critically important in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. The other thing, this and other data has really changed the way I talk to patients about this. Patients don't want to know about the history of we used to give, ADT alone, and now we have this information. When I'm meeting new patients with, particularly with de novo metastatic disease, I say the standard of care is an injection and a pill. Then I go into explaining ADT and the AR pathway inhibitor, and prescribe it to them on the day I start the ADT. We don't need to add drama to this and have a conversation about whether we should or shouldn't do it. We have compelling level one evidence for an overall survival benefit, not just from this trial, but from across all these other trials. The secondary question then becomes, should I also add docetaxel? And that's going to be a conversation based on the age and health of the patient and the severity of their disease. So there's a lot of this conversation, high volume, low volume, recurrent versus de novo, but what we saw from Aerosens is that the benefit in overall survival is similar for either de novo or recurrent, which is, as different in prognosis as it is for high volume and low volume. And we'll see more data in the future about those subgroups from Aerosens. So I'm really thinking about what is the patient's cancer-specific mortality as to whether or not I'll add docetaxel. So very different conversation with a 50-year-old man versus an 85-year-old man.
So, we've been hearing what you just said from a lot of investigators since the GU meeting when these data were presented. And, I've just been thinking about it in terms of why you come to that conclusion. Because tell me if I had this correct. I don't believe there's any data on, your approach of, AR pathway inhibitor and ADT plus or minus docetaxel. That's not what Aerosens was. Is there any trial that looked at that?
No, you're absolutely right. So the reason I didn't answer your earlier question is the reason we chose this as the control group is I think we did the right thing, which we chose the winning arm of the previous trial, not the losing arm, the winning arm, which from charted in the early Stampede trials was show that the addition of docetaxel to ADT improved survival. So we did the difficult thing and chose the winning arm as the control group. And show that just even with an active comparator of ADT docetaxel, there's a benefit to adding an AR pathway inhibitor. The question, of course, doesn't answer is whether you really need the docetaxel. But the consistency and strength of observations about AR pathway inhibition versus ADT alone, versus ADT docetaxel across multiple trials, different drugs, leads me to conclude that that's the priority. And really, docetaxel is an important but secondary consideration. So for me, it's I'm advising my patients who need intensification. We're going to give you ADT and an AR pathway inhibitor. We're going to start those right now. As we get to know each other, we're going to make the decision about whether we should also add docetaxel. I need to know you a little better. I need to know more about your health, your other medications, and your priorities.
But if the hormone therapy the patient was on was abiraterone or enzalutamide or apalutamide, you still okay adding docetaxel?
I'd be less happy. We have good data. We have great data, I would say, for darolutamide, including very favorable safety data that argues that there's very a little additional toxicity for the addition of daro to ADT docetaxel. Abiraterone, we have safety data from PEACE-1, although there's more toxicity with the triplet there. And we have very limited information for ENZA and APA. So if I'm planning to give docetaxel, my go-to drug is darolutamide. I think it's best in class for tolerability and the efficacy across all four of these drugs appears to be indistinguishable.
So, and yeah, and the ESMO data, there's a bunch of really amazing curves showing, all kinds of issues, time of falls, fractures, fatigue, everything you looked at, I don't see very much difference.
The argument could be like some of the safety is hidden by docetaxel. So most of this, in both patients right. in both arms are getting, so most of the side effects you're seeing in Aerosens are due to docetaxel, not to darolutamide.
Right.
And they're consistent across the arms. But we also have even more compelling data from Aramis, which are asymptomatic patients with non-metastatic CRPC, true placebo-controlled trial. And the patients just continued their ADT, which they've been on for years. And there's very little difference between darolutamide and placebo, which again makes the argument that it's a very well-tolerated drug. So certainly from a patient safety tolerability issue, there should be very little pushback about adding such a drug, knowing that we're improving overall survival.
Yeah, I mean, you were really in the middle of those conversations. And I was kind of surprised when Aramis came out that there was going to be, an anti-androgen that, had a different toxicity profile. And you really were the person in the middle of all that. And I guess one of the keys, or at least theoretically, was CNS penetration. Is that
accurate? So darolutamide was developed, that candidate molecule darolutamide was developed as a drug because it did not cross the blood-brain barrier. And so it was predicted to have better safety. And, the clinical data we have from the trial suggests that that's the case.
And then did we learn anything more about what goes on with anti-androgens, particularly enzalutamide, with, quote, fatigue that I hear from a lot of you is maybe some kind of neurologic dysfunction? Like, what's going on? Is this a direct CNS effect of, for example, enzalutamide?
It's hard to be sure. Certainly darolutamide, which is crosses the blood-brain barrier poorly or not at all, appears to have less fatigue. There's a little fatigue there. There's more fatigue with APA and ENZA. It may be a central effect due to, AR inhibition in the brain. It may be part of this continuum of CNS toxicity of ENZA and APA, the extreme of which is rare, seizures. But the fatigue that is seen in some patients, or the severe fatigue that is seen in some patients, may be a CNS toxicity.
Is it, kind of like what you see with, benzodiazepam or sedatives? You've done a lot of work on falls. It looks like with drugs like enzalutamide, you do see more falls. What's the pathophysiology? Is it like a sedative, a CNS effect?
I think it's probably, my speculation is that it's like along this continuum of CNS toxicity, right? So if you have fatigue, balance alterations, you're more likely to fall, you're more likely to fracture. And both of those are true in the case of apalutamide and enzalutamide in non-metastatic CRPC, where you do see a small excess risk of falls and fractures reported as adverse events in those trials.
Are there any complementary strategies to help with the, quote, fatigue that you see on these agents, exercise or anything related to sleep, anything you can do outside of pharmacologic support or dose reduction?
Yeah, it's worth noting, of course, that all these patients are on the backbone of ADT. So androgen deprivation therapy alone increases fatigue, results in body composition changes, including muscle loss, fat accumulation, mild anemia. So these are just constellation of things that contributes to fatigue. And so it's part of our care of our patients to really focus on survivorship, make patients aware of these issues when they initiate therapy, and help them develop constructive therapies to combat those. Those include some of the approaches you described: regular exercise, healthy diet, efforts to avoid weight gain, good sleep hygiene. All of those things are important for all of us, and they become particularly important for older men on androgen deprivation therapy and these other chronic treatments.
I try not to get carried away with the chat room. There's so many great questions. We could spend the whole time on that, but just to pick out a couple that I thought were kind of interesting. One from Nicholas: when you start a patient like that on a high-risk metastatic patient or ADT and AR pathway, with docetaxel. Do you think some of the issue with the does the AR pathway cover up the initial testosterone surge? Is that part or not?
It would. So So in patients where I'm concerned about a flare, first, I mean, I've been doing this for quite a while, and true flares are like few and far between. I wouldn't need both hands to count all the true flares that I've seen in 25 years of practice. But in patients where I am concerned, they're symptomatic, either with obstructive voiding symptoms or pain due to metastatic disease, I avoid the flare entirely by giving a GnRH antagonist. So very commonly, I'm starting, you know, patients with high volume metastatic, de novo metastatic disease on Degarelix and immediately starting their AR pathway inhibitor. You know, I don't prescribe an the first or second generation anti-androgens to block the flare, because if I'm worried about a flare, I give the antagonist. And the priority is to give a survival prolonging drug, one of those four, you know, modern AR pathway inhibitors, including darolutamide. So I don't prescribe bicalutamide really at all to block a flare, because if I'm worried about a flare, I give Degarelix, and I'm going to start darolutamide based on level one evidence of improved survival.
So speaking of bicalutamide, again, going back to our incredible chat room here, Rajiv has in her practice, a local oncologist has just retired, and now many of the oncologist patients have come into Dr. Khanna's practice, and the previous doc used bicalutamide. So should they be, she has a bunch of patients that are doing well on bicalutamide, should they be switched?
Is that monotherapy, bicalutamide monotherapy?
No, with ADT, with ADT.
ADT. Yeah, so so-called combined androgen blockade. So, you know, I do acknowledge that it's very challenging to inherit patients, particularly if they've been cared for in a chronic disease where they might have been on this for a long time. So I usually, when I'm meeting such patients, avoid making any therapeutic changes unless absolutely necessary till I at least get to know them and have their trust. But if they're not progressing, then I think it would be fine to continue the bicalutamide. I have not done that in used combined androgen blockade for more than a decade, so it's not something I would encourage. And if they're stable, it'd be hard case to make that they should be switched to a more potent drug.
So Danny is questioning the need for ADT in patients with IBRN, and we have a case in a second that's going to get into that. Anyhow, this is another ongoing study. It's kind of interesting that this wasn't the first one reported, the Aronaut, which is kind of like more like the other studies, which is ADT plus or minus, right? And we're going to get the same kind of answer, presumably with a better tolerability profile.
Hard to imagine otherwise. But yeah, so this is to fill in the gap, which is like, you know, are we sure that darolutamide is combination with ADT more effective than ADT alone? Of course, the answer is yes, it should be. But this will just fill in the gap and hopefully expand the label, FDA label, to include ADT Daro as an FDA approved regimen.
Do you have any issues doing that outside of clinical trial right now, or any problems accessing darolutamide in that situation without docetaxel?
I have no problem using ADT and darolutamide for MHSPC without docetaxel. Look, I mean, we have to look across this extraordinary data set of multiple trials, different drugs, slightly different eligibility, doublet, triplet. And what's clear and consistent message is that AR pathway inhibition improves overall survival. And that doesn't require that, you know, and that would be true without docetaxel with darolutamide for sure. So I have no concerns about the appropriateness of doing that. We haven't had much in the way of problems getting that approved, with few exceptions. And I think it's the best in class for tolerability. And so particularly for older, frailer patients with bad disease, I want to offer them that survival benefit, but at the lowest possible risk of side effects. So for that reason, my preferred drug is darolutamide, whether or not I'm using docetaxel.
All right, let's get back to another case, more recent development. And this is a patient of Dr. Morris, who, as I mentioned, is a urologic oncologist. Patient with Gleason 4 plus fluor. I think it was 6 out of 7 cores. PSA of 147. Still being worked up at the time that I talked to him, but the CT was negative. So locally advanced until not too long ago, you know, kind of straightforward 2 years of ADT. But of course, we have some new data. Here's Dr. Mars.
68, fairly healthy, but significantly elevated PSA, and certainly fits the Stampede definition for high risk, non-metastatic hormone sensitive. And so I would just kind of float this to the panelists. Is this a slam dunk question of we would add in abiraterone with our ADT therapy based on the conventional imaging being negative, or should we obtain a PSMA and consider some combination of local therapy if we can find something that could be targeted? And if they have no metastatic lesions, would you just depend on the local therapy to see if they have a response before resigning them to 2 years of abiraterone and ADT? In terms of the recently published Stampede arm of this study looking at non-metastatic men with very high risk of metastatic spread, I just wanted the faculty to comment on what would be considered a new standard of care for those patients.
Any comments?
Yeah, great case. And what I'd say is we would do a PSMA PET-CT to state-of-the-art technology. It's a disruptive technology. It's 10 to 100-fold more sensitive than conventional imaging, and a patient like this very likely will have detectable metastatic disease. If you can't get that, I would treat him as NCCN very high-risk disease, and based on Stampede, add abiraterone to ADT, and then either prostate and nodal radiation. Interestingly, though, what does the additional information about metastatic disease? There's a remarkable convergence, right? Like, so if he had low volume de novo metastatic disease, we would recommend ADT, an AR pathway inhibitor, and prostate radiation. So it's not that different. Like, the core backbone of what we're doing is the same. If he has metastatic disease, perhaps and he can't have radiation to all metastatic sites, maybe his systemic therapy will be lifelong rather than 2 to 3 years. If he has de novo metastatic disease, maybe you radiate the prostate but not the pelvic nodes, and then you're going to be radiating, you know, specific sites of metastatic disease if that's feasible. But I would do PSMA PET-CT and absolutely intensify the systemic treatment. He's going to have prostate radiation and then potentially nodal radiation or radiation to sites of detected metastatic disease.
And if there is no metastatic disease, only abiraterone, if you were diabetic, would you be okay giving them, you know, enzalutamide or darolutamide?
Yeah, take your pick of the other drugs. But yeah, so, you know, we have the data from Stampede. I have every reason to believe that, you know, the same would be true with other drugs. We'll have that information formally when the results of other studies, including the ATLAS trial readout of apalutamide in high-risk localized prostate cancer. So
we've gotten a lot of questions in the chat room, and you mentioned it briefly, but about LHRH antagonists. This is a patient with a prior coronary artery disease, had a stent placement, and now has then had Gleason 4+4, got external beam radiation in 2013, now has a PSA relapse with a six-month doubling time. Here's Dr. Carr.
When I saw this patient, I ordered a PSMA PET scan for him, which did not show any suspicious area of radiotracer accumulation. He has been started on hormonal therapy with Degarelix. And just after the first two shots, his PSA number has started to come down.
What are the questions you'd like to hear discussed about this patient?
We recently have been able to have access to the PSMA PET scanning. Is there any consensus among the experts, like if, you know, a gallium 68 PSMA PET versus F18 flucyclovine or the C11? The reason for choosing Degarelix basically was patient's significant cardiac history.
There is a oral antagonist, relugolix.
Are they seeing the same amount of the compliance in the patients with the patients having to take, or have they noticed in practice whether the shots is still a better way of treatment?
We're talking about going to San Antonio. It's interesting. They don't have an oral LHRH agonist, or at least I don't think relugolix has been studied in it. But anyhow, any thoughts about this case and her questions?
Yeah, good case. So I guess I'd begin by saying, you know, so first the imaging question, you know, the different tracers, you know, Pylarify versus, you know, gallium PSMA PET imaging agents are bioequivalent. So meaning that the images are superimposable. So it's really going to be your nuclear medicine team's decision of which imaging agent in a setting like this. I have no concerns about which agent. They're going to provide the same operating characteristics. I'm very reassured that this patient had no detectable prostate cancer by PSMA PET, and I would have been inclined to observe him off treatment. You know, with the 6-month doubling time, it may not be for long, but if you could get him another 6 months, year, 2 years without treatment, you're avoiding side effects, and we have no compelling evidence that we're diminishing his long-term outcome by that delay. I think the choice of a GnRH antagonist was a good one based on concerns about cardiovascular safety. I mean, the priority is always going to be maximum cancer control, but in a patient like this with, you know, a very recent serious cardiac history, I think that's the best case to use an antagonist over an agonist. For patient convenience, we would use relugolix rather than monthly degarelix in a patient like that who's going to be on treatment for at least a year. But I think the issue raised about concerns about compliance are very real. It's the perfect setup, right? Men don't like the side effects of ADT, and now they have a pill at their hand that they can just choose not to take this week. It has a rapid on effect. It also has a rapid off effect. So non-compliance could have issues. At least that wasn't observed in the trials, but real world and trials don't always align perfectly.
Yeah, that issue was brought up to me by the breast people when I said, why don't you have something like relugolix? And you know, as you mentioned, you know, they are so critical. You're using aromatase inhibitor. It's not going to work if they don't take it. And here's another case that brings up a really interesting question. I don't know how often you might have dealt with this, but I'm sure you have seen it. So this is a 66-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Malik, who gets external beam radiation therapy for a primary prostate cancer, but then has M0 progression. Before I go on with that, just getting back to what you were just saying. So just the PSA doubling time of 6 months in M0 situations, not necessarily enough for you to treat? Is 3 or 4 months different?
Well, the shorter the worse, right? We have this additional very reassuring piece of information that is PSMA PET CT, this exquisitely sensitive scan shows no detectable cancer, right? So the worry with a patient with the rapid doubling time and negative conventional imaging is you might be missing something and they're going to symptomatically progress before your eyes off treatment. I'm very reassured with a negative PSMA PET that that's extremely unlikely to occur. And I would be inclined to defer treatment. If the patient's like, doc, I want treatment, I'm not willing to wait, then I think it'd be totally reasonable to treat him. But we have to consider what our goal is, right? Like, if we want to avoid symptomatic progression, I would say his risk is extremely low if he has no detectable disease on an exquisitely sensitive PSMA PET CT. And so I would be comfortable observing such a patient, particularly if I had concerns about cardiovascular safety and other things, as was raised in that specific case.
So just for example, if you have a patient who's got a PSA doubling time of a year, does that automatically mean you're going to hold off?
That's a patient. So these disease states like so-called biochemical only recurrence or M0, Neil, they're being compressed and eliminated, right? So as we get more sensitive imaging, we don't have patients who are PSA only recurrence for years and years because you do a PSMA PET CT and they're reclassified as metastatic disease or an isolated local recurrence. So we're correctly reclassifying them and I think making better treatment decisions. And some would say, well, that's just a bad news story. You're just upstaging everyone, you know, your stage migration. It's not uniformly true, right? Like in this patient, where the concern was he has a short PSA doubling time, this is bad, the PET imaging is very reassuring. And so that should enable us to consider a more cautious approach in such a patient, particularly one where there were these expressed concerns about the cardiovascular safety of the treatment.
So getting back to this patient of Dr. Malik, as I mentioned, the patient had primary radiation therapy, PSA progression, the M0, was put on an LHRH agonist, leuprolide, had a response, but did not like being on treatment and stopped it and refused to take it. And now the PSA is going up. Here's Dr. Malik.
This 66-year-old male was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma of the prostate in 2013. He was treated in another facility with external beam radiation and presented in 2017 with a biochemical recurrence. This patient, by his urologist, was started on Lupron and started to have a lot of erectile dysfunction fatigue, and he didn't want to be on Lupron anymore. So I started him on 1,000 milligrams of abiraterone, and he decided not to do the Lupron and had an excellent response. His PSA dropped to less than 0.4. He's approximately now 3 years out. He was still having a lot of fatigue and weakness, erectile dysfunction, but he lived a pretty normal life. He goes golfing, but he was still complaining a lot about the erectile dysfunction and fatigue. I see a lot of prostate cancer patients, so a lot of them have hot flashes. I usually treat them with Effexor. A lot of them have erectile dysfunction as well. Fatigue is a common problem or a complaint.
Did you ever get a testosterone level on him?
I did. His testosterone level is extremely low.
So any comments about the case? And I don't know, perhaps you've seen cases like this where people just won't take an LHRH agonist.
It's a part of my everyday practice, right? So men don't like medical castration very much, and for good reason, for all the side effects that Dr. Malik nicely outlined. I wouldn't recommend abiraterone acetate monotherapy as an alternative to ADT. It's an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor. As we heard in this case, it may have been the cause of his dramatically low testosterone years off of Lupron, right? So you'd expect abiraterone, an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor alone, to lower testosterone. It may not do it as consistently or as well as Lupron, but it's going to achieve a low testosterone, result in a response, particularly in a patient without metastatic disease like this one, and surprisingly durable response. But it also was accompanied by the expected side effects of a low testosterone. So I'm not sure it really provided a quality of life benefit for the patient, and you know, comes with additional potential side effects associated with abiraterone.
So does abiraterone work without ADT? Do the antiandrogens work without ADT? I know there was like the biggest trial ever done in oncology, like 9,000 men, mm-hmm. adjuvant by high dose bicalutamide, I think without ADT, which was negative. But do any of these things work without ADT?
They sure do. Very little information about abiraterone as monotherapy, but you know, as expected, it would lower testosterone and achieve responses. My understanding is through feedback, to consistently maintain castrate levels of testosterone, you would need higher doses of abiraterone, which then gets you into other safety concerns. So that's not going to be an approach that's likely developed going forward. Anti-androgen monotherapy, you referred to the bicalutamide data. Those were negative trials, probably because the drug's not very good and they studied patients at too low risk for progression. So that combination doomed those trials in retrospect. We have data from phase 2 studies looking at monotherapy with enzalutamide and other drugs. It's very active. It's also with more potent AR inhibition. It's accompanied by similar but not completely overlapping side effects. So sexual dysfunction, fatigue, body composition changes are all observed with enzalutamide monotherapy, very similar to what you see with ADT. The best way to avoid side effects of ADT is to avoid treatment, as long as you safely can. There are, of course, many scenarios where that's not the right approach. And we struggle with cases. I saw one today of a young guy with horrendous metastatic prostate cancer who has decided to come off treatment and says he will never go back on treatment. Very difficult cases.
Wow. So I was going to ask you something before, and I said, well, I'll hold off. And then here it is in the chat room from Navin, who actually has a case of what I was thinking about, because you were talking about small cell transfer and neuroendocrine transformation. De novo, pure neuroendocrine prostate cancer, but the cancer cells are PSA positive, high volume, bone node liver mets, PSA 300. Would be doing carboplatin. I would also ask, I don't know whether you would use a checkpoint inhibitor the way they do in small cell, But Nabin wants to know, what about androgen blockade on top of that, even though it's neuroendocrine because of the fact that the PSA is positive?
So this is congratulations, you found a case of primary small cell carcinoma of the prostate. These are few and far between. We see a few a year. But this is actually a mixed histology, right? So his with a PSA of 300 cannot be explained by small cell carcinoma. So he has this mixed histology. He certainly should receive lifelong ADT. I think I support the choice of chemotherapy there. Absolutely a priority. And the rare time we see such cases, we certainly would consider addition of a checkpoint inhibitor by, inference from the data in small cell lung cancer.
So this next case, actually, Dr. Kumar is in the chat room now. He's probably going to add stuff to this that maybe I missed in the case. But anyhow, he's a young patient, 53-year-old man, status post-prostatectomy, salvage radiation, but continues to have a slowly rising PSA. PSMA scan denied by insurance, currently being appealed. Here's Dr. Kumar's questions.
So this is a very interesting situation. He's 53 years old, 2014, at age 46, Gleason score 7, 3 plus 4, adenocarcinoma of the prostate. He got radical prostatectomy, pelvic lymph node sampling. Subsequently, he had biochemical recurrence in 2017, 3 years later. Got salvage radiation to the prostate bed. So he is still castrate sensitive, biochemical relapse after a salvage radiation, clinically doing well. When do I pull the trigger for hormonal therapy? How would you choose an anti-androgen therapy in a patient who has a castrate-sensitive, non-metastatic prostate cancer? Is the choosing criteria same as for the metastatic disease, or you have different criteria in choosing the anti-androgen therapy? The oral antagonist versus the injectable antagonist, is there any difference in the degree to which the rebound recovery of testosterone occurs? And is this particular agent is more suitable for intermittent therapy compared to the agonist? Is there any data for that?
Any comments?
Yeah, so this is a good case. It's kind of the corollary, right, to those, aggressive, high volume, high risk de novo cases we talked about. What do you do with a patient with a slowly rising PSA where you were talking about, does he need treatment? Is it continuous versus intermittent? And so the further you move away from poor prognosis to better prognosis, I look to defer treatment. The dilemma we confronted with conventional imaging is we had these years, 5-10 years in some cases, of a patient with a rising PSA before you had detectable metastatic disease. We're compressing that by identifying metastatic disease earlier, identifying disease earlier. But I'd wait till, and the mantra kind of goes, treat it when you can see it, right? That's not going to uniformly be the case, but I'd be in absolutely no rush. Part of the art of practicing in a patient like this is convincing him that it's okay after all this treatment to now wait. I'd wait till he has a PSMA PET CT. You can appeal that. You'll get it done eventually, not this year, next year. And if he has no detectable metastatic disease, I would observe him. If he has limited sites of metastatic disease, which is quite possible in the scenario that's described, then you have to consider whether you're going to go chasing after those additional pelvic lymph nodes or other sites of metastatic disease. But I would avoid treatment right now.
Yeah, I'd be a lot more comfortable avoiding treatment if I could get a PSMA PET scan sooner than a year from now.
Yeah, so I would agitate about that. But, at a PSA 1.3, there's a good chance, but far from a certainty, that you're going to see detectable metastatic disease. So I don't know why the denial occurred. We have seen denials where it said that the PSA isn't high enough and the cutoff was like 2. So I don't know where that comes from. I think it's it comes from some of the studies, but that's not the labeled use of the agent. There are ways to get around that. A motivated patient can go to another country and get the scan out of pocket for, in some cases less than the copayment would be in the United States.
Interesting. So, yeah, we have the best chat room ever here. I've got people putting in stuff, and I'm not sure whether I'm even following it. But anyhow, Steve quotes a paper from Investigative Clinical Urology 2020 that showed enzalutamide without ADT was actually worse. I guess it was a Korean retrospective analysis. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Any evidence that it actually creates problems?
Worse for treating cancer? So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know that study. What I can say is, it was studied in a prospective trial. So I'm not proposing enzalutamide monotherapy as a standard alternative to ADT. There is a larger study, ongoing study called EMBARK, that will address those questions in a rigorous way. But I think for the occasional patient where, androgen deprivation therapy with a GnRH agonist or antagonist is completely unacceptable to him based on previous experience, there are other ways to consider that, and I would submit that enzalutamide monotherapy might be an option. Not my first choice of treatment, but it might be an option for a patient who will not accept conventional ADT.
Any comments on intermittent ADT? In what situations are you using it, and how do you do it?
Sure. So for us, intermittent ADT, we probably use less of it now because with PSMA PET CT, we're emboldened to monitor, observe patients without detectable metastatic disease and treat those who have it. So the patients I give intermittent ADT are either low, very low burden metastatic disease, or recurrent PSMA PET only disease, for example, indolent disease, where you feel like you need to treat them, but you don't need to intensify therapy. There, I might use intermittent ADT. We treat them for a year, discontinue treatment, and then resume treatment when they progress. It is a bit of a conundrum, though, right? Because we now have this evidence that intensifying systemic treatment improves survival. That's continuous treatment and addition of an AR pathway inhibitor. But there are these patients out there who are going to have, late recurrent metastatic disease, node only, where they have a good enough prognosis that you may not need to intensify therapy. And that's why I was very careful to qualify, with few exceptions, we should be intensifying therapy. But there are exceptions to that, older, frail patients and or patients with very indolent, low-burden disease, particularly these sort of PSMA PET-only disease patients in the recurrent setting.
So one final case, and I actually had a couple of cases like this. I'm going to present the other one in the other conference we're going to do. But interesting situation. This is a 77-year-old man who starts out with external beam radiation therapy, then gets ADT for PSA relapse, and then gets cryoablation, and then has progression, still no evidence of Mets, and is now on enzalutamide responding, but initially, but now the PSA is increasing, and on a PET scan has uptake in the prostate gland, in the left side of the prostate gland, after having had external beam and later on cryoablation. Here's Dr. Apuri.
This gentleman is very active. He plays tennis every day. So ECOG of zero, due to his underlying diabetes, we decided to go ahead with enzalutamide. And he did very well on the enzalutamide overall. Side effect profile was very manageable. There was fatigue, but his PSA did decline to 3.3. He's already been on treatment now for 18 months. However, in the past 3-4 months, the PSA is slowly starting to rise again, and now it's a 4.9. So we did an auximin PET scan, and there is still continues to be a focus of uptake in the left base. Now the SUV is reported as a 5. He got the cryoablation. So would they consider any local treatment to the prostate, given his history? I would love Dr. Smith to tell me, does he see the PSMA better than the auximin? In which patients would he suggest doing the PSMA upfront rather than doing any other PET scan?
Did this man have any problems with the enzalutamide?
So definitely fatigue has been the biggest concern or the biggest issue. He does not have any mental cloudiness. He's fully functional. And we have tried switching the medication from daytime to nighttime to see if there would be a change.
Any thoughts?
Sure. So a few things. So, the operating characteristics of PSMA PET-CT are unequivocally superior to fluciclavine PET-CT. So I don't believe I will do a the latter scan ever again. We would, if we're going to do a PET scan, it's going to be PSMA PET CT. But I think you learned what you wanted to learn. In this case, he does appear to have a local recurrence. It's not clear to me that he's really at substantial risk for near-term clinical progression. The idea of doing a third local treatment in a 77-year-old man who's had prior radiation and cryo, I'd say, is probably pretty much out of the question until and if he were to develop a symptomatic local recurrence. I might like to get an MRI of his prostate just to see how extensive this local recurrence is. And my inclination would be to hold the course on his current systemic treatment and avoid any changes, because you don't have lots of good options. But the good news for him is I think he's probably at pretty low risk for clinical or symptomatic progression in the next year or two. And so you may get away with just maintaining the current systemic treatment.
So I just want to finish with a couple other case scenarios real quick to run by you. So this first scenario is a younger patient who has disease progression after receiving an LHRH agonist, abiraterone, and docetaxel for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. Any thoughts about these options? I would think that further hormonal therapy might not be the best idea, but maybe might be interesting what your thoughts about lutetium. We make this bone-only meds versus radium versus cabazi versus maybe a docetaxel retreatment.
Yeah, so I think the latter options you raised would all be reasonable considerations. We do have clear information that the AR pathway inhibitor switch is inactive, so I wouldn't support doing that either as monotherapy or in combination with another treatment. If it had been a long interval since his prior docetaxel, I'd probably retreat him with docetaxel. Shorter interval or no interval, then I would be inclined to give him PSMA lutetium as the next step. I would prioritize that over radium, even though he'd be a candidate for either treatment. Cabazitaxel is not a wrong choice. We don't have formal sequencing information to know whether he should get cabazitaxel or PSMA lutetium as the next line of therapy. There's at least the therapy study was a randomized phase two study that suggested that lutetium PSMA was better than cabazitaxel, but those were in patients who were highly selected for PSMA lutetium, including having met certain PET criteria. So one of the things I'd want to know about this patient is the results of his PSMA PET scan to determine if he's a candidate, number one, which is 85% chance he would be, but then within that spectrum, is it highly avid or only modestly avid? And that might help me prioritize selection of sequencing.
So I had to squeeze in just a little bit of Propel magnitude here. And I think there are endocrine issues, though, with that strategy, because that was done with abiraterone. We know there's I think it's a talazoparib trial that's going to be reported. So there's a press release out saying it's a positive in the same castrate-resistant situations that we'll see. But right now, we just have PARP plus abiraterone that I know. So what do you do in a patient who has prior ADT for M0 disease, now metastatic, but has a germline BRCA?
Sure. So, you know, BRCA2 mutation, particularly those with germline, you know, the best probably possible biomarker selection for benefit from a PARP inhibitor. So I'm going to prioritize treatment with a PARP inhibitor in such a patient. And I would be either AR pathway inhibitor followed by a PARP inhibitor, or in a patient like this, I would consider the combination based on the results of PROPEL, not an approved combination yet, but they're going to get the PARP inhibitor eventually. The best evidence for benefit from the combination with the intermediate endpoint of RPFS was in patients who were biomarker positive, and particularly those with BRCA mutations. So I think that you could make a good case for the combination. I still don't want to see longer follow-up, including survival data in all of the cohorts.
Combination ABI, or your combination any of these?
Well, PARP inhibitor. So the best data, the full data set that we have reported that would support this, I guess best data would be olaparib with abipred. Because of drug-drug interactions, you'd have to go with that combination. In case of talazoparib, it was developed in combination with enzalutamide. So when we have more information, at least in theory, that would be if positive, that would be a potential alternative. So there will be interesting choices to make. Like if you are going to use the combination in such a patient, you know, are you going to prioritize that decision based on the PARP or the AR pathway inhibitor or both. And there may be reasons to choose one over the other, depending on the patient's age, health, comorbidities, and concurrent medications.
And just to finish it out, and this question, I've yet to have anybody say they use a PARP inhibitor other than the principal investigator, Fred Sod, of the PROPEL trial. But we're saying the patient, no BRCA, no HRR, nothing. Would you give PARP?
I mean, there was benefit in
the PROPEL trial.
There is benefit, but this is a patient who I would otherwise not give PARP monotherapy. And the data from the combination, I'd say, the benefit in the intermediate endpoint of RPFS in the biomarker negative cohort, I would describe as modest, and I really want to see longer follow-up, including survival data. I'm prepared to be convinced otherwise, but in the absence of an overall survival benefit, I think that's going to be a difficult approach to adopt.
So Matthew, thank you so much for working with us today. We all learned a lot, and we're going to be working with your colleague tomorrow talking about another super exciting area in oncology, the use of BCMA and CAR T therapy in multiple myeloma, bispecifics as well as CAR T. And we actually have some patients that we're going to show as well. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you, audience.